This episode is brought to you by Yotta Energy. That's Y-O-T-T-A Energy. We all know energy storage is key to deploying renewables at scale. I've seen many energy storage solutions for commercial buildings over my years in clean tech, but none as impressive as Yotta's. Yotta Energy's unique PV-coupled ecosystem of solar plus storage solutions simply integrates within the standard solar installation process. Even better, their integrated storage technology can enable up to 60% more solar to be deployed on commercial buildings. With commercial buildings consuming 35% of U.S. electricity, that means Yotta is making a serious dent in CO2 emissions. With the electrification of everything revolution underway, Yotta Energy is poised to meet the growing demands of electrification by sizing solar plus storage resources to recharge electric vehicles as they future-proof buildings into distributed energy sites powering the grid of the future. Find out more at yottaenergy.com and follow Yotta on Twitter at Yotta Energy. This episode is also brought to you by Aether Diamonds. That's A-E-T-H-E-R Diamonds. If you're planning to propose or purchase a timeless gift for your partner, I couldn't think of a better purchase than Aether Diamonds. Aether Diamonds are the world's most sustainable diamonds and the only diamonds that are actually good for the planet. Aether creates the world's first positive impact diamonds made from captured CO2. In fact, every carat of Aether Diamonds offsets your personal carbon footprint for over a year. These are 100% real diamonds with a real impact. They're some of the highest quality diamonds you can buy and are certified by IGI, the world's largest independent laboratory for testing and grading gemstones and fine jewelry. Now you're no longer stuck having to choose between mined and regular lab-grown diamonds, both of which harm the environment. Aether offers the only truly sustainable diamonds on the market, requiring no ethical or environmental trade-offs. In other words, they're the only guilt-free diamonds available in the world. To learn more about these revolutionary diamonds from air, visit their website at aetherdiamonds.com and follow on Twitter at aetherdiamonds. Hello, my fellow climate warriors. This is Matt Myers, and welcome to another episode of Climate Tech Cocktails, where we grab a drink or two with best-in-class climate tech founders to learn from their life journeys, dive into bleeding-edge technologies, and have a laugh while we're at it. My guest today is BJ Johnson, co-founder and CEO of Clear Flame Engines. You can find BJ at BJ_Johnson87 on Twitter and also Clear Flame Engines on Twitter at ClearFlameENG. BJ Johnson is CEO and co-founder of Clear Flame Engines, which is a startup taking the diesel fuel out of the diesel engine for heavy-duty industries. BJ leads business development, fundraising, and strategic planning operations at Clear Flame. BJ received his PhD in mechanical engineering from Stanford in 2015 while developing the technology used by Clear Flame. At Stanford, BJ was supported by fellowships from the National Science Foundation, the Achievement Rewards for College Scientists, and Stanford School of Engineering. BJ was also a member of the USA Swimming National Team, representing the United States at World Championships and participating as a leader in USA Swimming Diversity Camps. Without further ado, enjoy the show. BJ Johnson, welcome to the show.
Hey, Matt. Thank you for having me.
So what are we drinking today?
Yeah, so my poison of choice was a Mamie Taylor. It's basically a Moscow Mule, but with scotch instead of the vodka. It's named for an opera singer, but it's a popular, or has been a popular beverage here on the Chicago area where I'm based. So I went for something with a little bit of a hometown feel.
Awesome. Okay, so it's a local drink, if you will.
I think it's got, I mean, it was initially invented in Rochester, where my director of marketing is from, by the way. But it's basically popular around the Midwest. It's been around for a while. It's kind of been replaced by the Moscow Mule. But like I said, this is my preferred take on it.
And what's in it?
Scotch, lime, ginger beer.
Awesome. And I'm using Glenfiddich today, along with good old Gosling's ginger beer and Nelly and Joe's famous Key West lime juice.
Okay, so we basically have the same drink. I have blended whiskey, blended Scotch whiskey. You have single malt. Yeah, okay.
Right. Oh, are you using Gosling's ginger beer?
I have Reed's. So close.
Okay, Bob Mumgard told me when we made a Dark and Stormy that you must use Gosling's ginger beer if you're going to use ginger beer. So now that is my go-to.
I will take this and I'll take this advice. I need to end it on my game there, obviously.
Great. So I want to begin our conversation with a quote. Fear is a mind killer. What does that quote mean to you?
Yeah, it's from Dune, for those that don't know. What it means to me is that you can't let fear paralyze you. Obviously, it's like a natural human emotion to feel, but one of the things that allows us to transcend that is to recognize the emotion, feel the emotion, realize what the emotion means, but then to take from the rest of the quote, basically let it pass through you and see the clarity of what you need to do unclouded by that emotion. And I think it's important to me to acknowledge the things that scare me personally for Clear Flame, whatever, but knowing I can make a rational decision despite that is, I find, very empowering.
What scares you most besides spiders?
Did someone tell you I was going to say spiders? Because
no,
is
I didn't.
Okay. God, what scares me most? I mean, look, there's always the obvious ones. And like, there's something happening to my family that will always terrify me. You know, when I think in a more abstract sense, I don't like things that make me feel like I'm out of control. I don't fear flying in any sort of rational way, but there's this sense of it being out of your control, right? And of course, flying's safer than driving, but at least driving, I can pretend I'm in control, right? I guess that makes me a control freak, but I think that's one of my other fears, loss of control.
I hear you. I'm flying to New York tomorrow morning, and I'm always afraid when I take off and land, because I think that's when the most crashes happen. But let's not talk about that.
I was going to say, if you're flying tomorrow, we did avoid that subject.
So where'd you grow up?
Seattle, Washington. So 18 years in Seattle. Did my undergrad and grad at Stanford in California in the Bay Area, and now I've been in Chicago for about 4.
Speaking of Seattle, after we finish this session, I have to admit, I still do fantasy football and I'm going to be doing my fantasy football bracket and I will not be selecting any of the sea chickens.
I know significantly worse names to call my team, so we'll let that slide. Mm. Russell, run up the fantasy points for you if you want it, but yeah, I would not disrespect you for not choosing Seahawks.
Okay, fair enough. You're going to hate me, actually. I probably shouldn't tell you that I'm a Cowboys fan.
So our EA and chief of staff, she's a Cowboys fan. It doesn't bug me. I'm a Packers fan, like my co-founder, Julie, that's a problem.
Yeah.
The Rams, they're a waste of time. but most of the rest, you're pretty much okay with me.
What about basketball? I guess you used to be a fan.
That is the way to put it. Yeah, I'll be a basketball fan when my Sonics come back. But you can't take a city's basketball team, man. Come on, what was that?
Yeah, I know. Will the Supersonics ever come back?
I hope so. I think the city still has the rights to the name. So when Seattle gets a team, the Sonics will be back. But there have been a couple fits and starts to make that happen. It hasn't happened yet. It'll happen. We'll get there.
I have a good friend from college who stopped watching NBA basketball when the Supersonics left Seattle.
I was one of the few Seattle people that actually still kind of liked the Thunder. Like the young Kevin Durant, James Harden, mm-hmm. Russell Westbrook was fun to watch. But yeah, it was hard knowing that was, you know, my team.
So moving on from basketball, you went to Stanford and you swam at Stanford, right?
Yeah, swam there undergrad, was lucky enough to be able to continue swimming throughout grad school and even to my first year here in Chicago. Big part of my life until just a few years ago.
You told me that you reached the U.S. national team.
Yeah, I was on the national team from 2012 to 2015, if I have the years right. Got to go a lot of cool places, Spain, Qatar, Australia, Israel on a different trip. Canada, which is always fun to have a nice local one. But yeah, I was a breaststroker for the national team for a few years in the middle of grad school.
Did that teach you anything about entrepreneurship at all? Or like do you use anything you learned in swimming for what you do now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's almost a cliched answer. But like, yeah, I think there are a lot of life lessons you can get from sports. I think from swimming in particular, a lot of it is discipline. One of the nice things about going to entrepreneurship of after swimming is whatever crappy might happen at Clear Flame, it's probably not worse than getting in an outdoor pool when it's like 35 degrees outside at 5 a.m. so that is always nice. And then just being able to deal with, you know, swimming can be a lonely sport. It's a great team sport and you got good people around you, but you're spending the most of your time staring at the black line at the bottom of the pool. And that learns to make you, I think, self-sufficient and self-motivated in some ways. And I think that combines with the discipline in a way that is pretty valuable for business in general and entrepreneurship for sure.
Yeah. I actually don't mind cold water so much anymore. I'm now practicing the Wim Hof method.
Oh, you are?
Yes. Although a watered down version of it.
It was the cold water just combined with, I mean, it's 20 hours a week of exhausting stuff on top of everything else you're trying to do. But again, that I think that pays off too. Like, you know, when I think of my hardest times at Clear Flame, it's been comparable to, you know, when I was wrapping up the PhD and still doing the national team stuff. That was good preparation just for the grind of it.
Oh, wow. And so when you say the national team, please bear with me because I'm not very up to speed on swimming. Like, I just watched the Olympics. That's basically as far as I go with swimming. Does that mean that you were competing to be on the Olympic team? Is that what being on the national team means?
Yeah, it's a little more specific than that. So there's kind of two senses of national team. There's the national team is defined as, you know, top six athletes in every event in the country. And then there's also some of the international trips. So like, you know, representing the U.S. at World Championships, for example, in 2013, that's a subset of the net. So never made the Olympics, but everything pretty much but.
Amazing. And so what was your PhD in?
My PhD is what ultimately became Clear Flame. I can't recite the like three line title of my dissertation defense, but basically it was how do you make an engine cleaner and more efficient by using high temperatures? And that ultimately morphed into Clear Flame because while making the engine more efficient was like a cool academic exercise, proving an engine could run efficiently really on any fuel and freeing up the engine to use whatever fuel makes most economic and environmental sense at a given time. That's kind of the origin story of Clear Flame there in a nutshell. And it was my PhD thesis, and it's cool to be putting that to use and seeing it grow into an actual product at this point.
Before we jump into the Clear Flame business, speaking of reciting things, I was told that you can recite The Empire Strikes Back backwards.
Ooh, I'm rusty at it. I can probably run through the script pretty close back to front still. But
really? Like the entire film?
I mean, I've seen it at least 100 times. It's by far and away the movie I've seen the most. So again, it's been a while back, and you know how some people use music while they're working or whatever? I would like borderline play Star Wars on repeat and only like two or three of the films, and by far and away that one the most. So yeah, I think it's still mostly in there. I can tell you the odds of successfully navigating an asteroid field, for example.
So it didn't surprise you or feel abnormal to you at all that I was playing Star Wars music in the green room before we started this podcast session. You're like, oh yeah, I'm used to that.
Oh yeah, didn't register at all. Normal background.
You're like, of course it's Star Wars music. So help me. Can you do like, say, the first few lines of the end of The Empire Strikes Back?
I mean, yeah. So, I mean, if you're talking about the end scene, like Luke has been rescued by Leia and Chewie and he's getting his hand stitched back together. And he's saying goodbye to Lando and Chewie that are going to rescue Han Solo. Lando's telling him, hey, when we find that bounty hunter, we'll reach out back to you and Leia. Luke does the whole, you know, may the force be with you. Chewie does his little Chewie growl. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Okay. You could just keep going all the way.
Well, then they pan to like the little galaxy in shot, but yeah, there's some dialogue missing in there.
Let's kind of change gears here and talk a bit more about Clear Flame. Was your intention to start a business?
Definitely not at the beginning. Definitely started as a very academic exercise. I thought I wanted to be a professor. You know, I think probably around halfway through the thesis work, so through the kind of 6-year process, was realizing, okay, there's real actual commercial value here. And, you know, I went in school in the middle of Silicon Valley, and there had been a company spun out of my lab 6-7 years before Julie and I were there. You know, something that was always kind of in our mind. I think realizing there was a real opportunity there was something came later on, though. Initially, it was just, hey, how do we show the world that there's a better way to make engines cleaner and more efficient, just in a very generic sense? And I think the transition to realizing that we wanted it to be a company was when we realized that wasn't going to happen unless we proved it ourselves and kept carrying that technology forward into the market. No one was going to pick it up and run with it. We had to do that.
But why focus on the engine out of all possible applications or problems to solve? You know, it could have been, well, I guess maybe you were focused on transportation with your PhD. And so you decided to focus on the engine. But if that is the case, why not EVs, right? Why not the electrification pathway versus the engine?
Yeah, I think it kind of goes one step back from even starting the PhD and how I got into energy in the first place.
Okay, and what does that look like?
Yeah, one of the things that Professor Chris Edwards, the professor who ultimately became my thesis advisor, always kind of taught in our thermo class is that there's two parts of the energy problem. There is the fact that we need to achieve sustainability. Of course, everyone knows that. But I mean, at the time, there was still over 1 billion people in the world that didn't have basic electricity. And I think we're just under that number, but we're still dang close to it, which frankly, as a species, is embarrassing. And we absolutely have to get serious about sustainability. But if we're not doing that in a way that is also expanding access to goods and energy in a way that we take for granted here in the United States, that a lot of people in the world don't have that luxury, we're not really solving the problem for all of humanity. And that was not good enough to me. I'm a huge believer in EVs. I'm a huge believer in electrification. I think the why not that is that even at that time, and you know, keep in mind, this is 2013, 2014, and Tesla's not what it was today, but it was still very clear that there were people working on EVs and how to make that a reality. There was no one talking about how are we going to start solving the problems for people that can't afford the products, can't have the infrastructure, don't have a clean and stable grid, that might not have anything at all besides the diesel engine that anyone in the world knows how to work on. How do we solve the problem for that person? It was just missing from the dialogue. And it was the obvious, I think EVs have just as much a role to play as what ClearFlame is doing. But there weren't a lot of people telling the ClearFlame side of the story, the what happens to the hard to electrify sectors. And so that's where we focused.
What do those sectors look like? I mean, there might be some people who are really familiar with transportation listening to this podcast, but I figure most people, when they're thinking of transportation, they'll start to think of their car engine, and then they'll think of other vehicles they see on the road. And we're talking about the United States, right? Then they'll think about EVs. But what you're addressing is entirely different. So can you paint a picture for the problem that you're solving when you're talking about solving the diesel engine problem?
Yeah. And my co-founder, Julie, says this better than I do. The way most people experience energy broadly, but in this kind of segment of the question, transportation, is from our individual experience, the Mazda 3 that I drive, that I wish could be an EV, and I think will be soon. A lot of what diesel powers is what we don't see. When we get the Amazon package, sure, the local delivery might come from an EV van, but if that had to move across the country, that was moved by a diesel truck. If it was moved across the ocean, that was a diesel engine. On rail, that was a diesel engine. The food we're eating, the grain that went into the whiskey that we are drinking, that was planted by a tractor running on diesel. And we just don't have that direct experience with it. And so when people think about the role for electric to play, electric vehicles do really well in relatively short ranges, relatively light loads, knowing that they're going to be parked for a while at a time. And so they're perfect for me. And like my car, if it was an EV car, could be charging right now. And I don't have to drive very far to get to work. But a diesel truck might go 500 miles into the middle of nowhere. The driver sleeps in the middle of nowhere and drives 500 miles the next day. Like that is a very different type of application where you have to rely on being self-contained within your vehicle. And that's where liquid fuels excel. It really is complementary. I think where diesel technology is the most needed is where ClearFlame is the weakest. Where diesel technology is the most needed is where ClearFlame is the strongest and EV is the weakest. Right. And where EV does well, we don't need diesel engines. I don't think people need a diesel Volkswagen Jetta anymore. But we're a long way away from being able to replace all of the diesel trucks. And we're even longer if you want to start talking about tractors, construction equipment, rail, all of the commercial industrial stuff.
So you're cleaning the hard to electrify engines or forms of transportation?
Yes. If you, and to steal from Julie again, you know, if you were to think of the diesel market as a giant candle, all the different wide ranges that diesel engines are used. You know, passenger cars are on one side and companies like Tesla are burning the candle at that end. ClearFlame is burning the candle at the other end. What's the hardest to electrify and working backwards? And I don't know exactly where that middle is, but the diesel problem is a big problem and we need to fight a two-front war on it.
How big is the problem? Not just in the United States, but globally.
Yeah, globally we're emitting about 5 gigatons of CO2 equivalent, which is mostly CO2, from diesel engines every year. So that's of about 38 to 40 total that we emit as a species. So you're looking at something like 15% of the entire problem is coming from that fuel in particular.
What about the United States when you look at that compared to the global figure?
Yeah, the United States, we burn about 60 billion gallons of diesel. It's smaller than the gasoline we use. And of course, we're a country where most cars are gasoline powered. That's not true in most of the world. So it is a little smaller here than it is in other countries. But I think when I think about the United States going forward, we're at 60 billion gallons of diesel and 100 something of gasoline. I forget that exact number. But I'd like to think that gasoline number is going to drop a lot. We're getting hybrids. We're getting more efficient cars. We're getting EVs. We're not going to need it. I don't think the number on that diesel front is going to budge much in the next 20 years unless we start exploring other fuels that can replace it.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate the explanation. Let's go back a bit to the founding of Clear Flame. How did you and Julie get to that point, right? And actually start the company. And when was that?
Probably around 2014, 2015. We started talking about, you know, it was still, Priority Run was still finishing our PhDs at that point, but thinking about what we wanted to do next. I know Julie had been looking at a couple other opportunities, but really we kind of coalesced around, again, like 2015 on, no, we want to do Clear Flame. We want to make this a reality. And we were probably naive enough at the time to think like, oh yeah, we're smart. This is a good idea. We'll just go walk over to Sand Hill Road. Sand Hill Road. I hear there's money there. We'll get some money. Yeah. Like we're good to go.
Yeah.
And so yeah, October 2016 is October 3rd is Clear Flame's official birthday. Officially formed it there. We really got off the ground in 2017 when we got the opportunity to move to Chicago, which is where we are now, to partner with Argonne National Lab as part of the Chain Reaction Innovations Program, which brought us in, put us on the ground using lab resources to not just continue development of our technology, but to give us the time we needed, frankly, just to learn what it takes to build a business, which I don't think we'd be here if myself in particular hadn't had the 2 years to transition from being an engineer to an entrepreneur and knowing that there was an environment that was willing to foster me in doing that. And that's exactly what Argonne and CRI provided.
Actually, that's when I met you all was 2017. Wow, time flies.
Birthday in Texas, yep.
Yeah, yeah. So for those who don't understand some of the names you just threw out, like Argonne and the acronym CRI, like what is Argonne National Laboratory? What goes on there? Is it like Stranger Things or not, right? And what's cool about a national lab? And how was your experience there? Let's talk a little bit about that.
There's totally Stranger Things stuff going on. They just don't let us see it. But no, so the national labs have been around for 60, 70 years at this point. They're independently operated, but the Department of Energy funds it to have labs that are doing basic fundamental research that is just critically important to the U.S. and how we evolve as a country with our energy policy and our energy technology. So Argonne is one of the very oldest labs. It's, I believe, still the largest. They work on a whole bunch of stuff. They also happen to have a Center for Transportation Research, which is what brought us there. They do a lot of work on engines and heavy duty engines. So Chain Reaction Innovations, we were the guinea pigs of that program. Very first year, very first cohort coming through it. Effectively, you know, I think the Department of Energy saw an opportunity where, you know, the labs had just tremendous resources that have been built up over decades. And if you stand in the engine test cell we had at Argonne, you could point around the room and be like, well, that costs $1 million. That costs $1 million. It's the type of tools to play with that no early stage startup has any right to expect. And Clear Flame had that opportunity because the Department of Energy was willing to take those resources that have been cultivated for national security, for defense, and begin deploying them to cultivate a generation of entrepreneurs focused on energy as well. And that's how we got Clear Flame. That's how we've gotten me and Julie. And I think we're on cohort 4 or 5 at this point, maybe even more than that.
Is Argonne the lab where they do the nuclear testing as well, and they have like the armed guards and the whole thing?
They do some nuclear work there. It's not as strict as some. And I actually made this mistake because I was used to going in and out of Argonne Lab, and you know, of course, they do security checks and stuff like that. But it's not the same level of security that you go through when they have the nuclear assets on site. And I was driving into Oak Ridge at one point.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that one is a lot more secure. And I get there and I realize like, oh, my ID's in the trunk. So I like, oh, pop out. Be like, let me just run to my trunk real quick and grab my ID. And the guard was like, whoa, 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 buddy. So I was like, did not get shot. That was a good step in the right direction. Good for Clear Flame. But yeah, it's Argonne's not quite that intense.
Okay. It's Oak Ridge that I was thinking of, not
Argonne. Los Alamos is also very much in that. Yeah. Some other ones as well. Yeah.
Yeah. But Los Alamos, that's where the aliens are, right?
Aliens are probably at all of them, let's be real. But yeah, I think that's where they're closest to first contact.
Awesome. So you were, you all did Stranger Things for a couple of years at Argonne, and you got to develop your technology. What was it like coming out of that program?
Yeah, you know, I think in the later stages of our time at Argonne, That's when we started getting our first seed investment, some groups out of Iowa, Joel Harris and Ag Startup Engine, a few other groups. And that's when we were kind of figuring out, okay, how do we transition? We have not outgrown Argonne yet, but when we need to have our own operation, how do we do that? And that's really, you know, 2019 to 2020 was the grind of getting the first institutional investment. So February 2020, Clean Energy Ventures stepped up, led that round. Allowed us to keep working with Argonne. We're collaborating with Argonne, but into our own facility and really move from an R&D demonstration to a true commercial demonstration, taking our first Cummins X15 engine, 500 horsepower engine, and showing like, yep, this works on the exact same type of engine that you would have in your truck.
Wait, I just want to double check. You said that you got funding from Iowa?
Iowa, and it was our very first funding was out of Iowa.
Really?
Yeah. It's what the Midwestern VC environment is going to be, I think, is something that the community is still figuring out as a whole. Yeah. But Iowa as a state has always been very entrepreneurial. I think the agriculture community as a whole has been very entrepreneurial. I mean, it's a sector where you literally live off what you grow, right? You have to be self-sufficient. And so they naturally inclined to think that way. And of course, ClearFarm has a ton of synergy with the biofuels community, the agriculture community, not just in the fuels that we use, but the diesel equipment that they use. So it's very synergistic. And they were the very first group to say, if this made it in a big way, this is good for us as a community, both in terms of the product we sell and the product we use. But also knowing this is someone that's coming and trying to understand our problem and not trying to sell us something that is wildly different than what we've done, mm-hmm. but make our way of life more compatible with a sustainable future. And that's what they want to hear. And that's what they need. And that's what they saw in ClearFlame.
Sorry for sounding shocked when I said Iowa, but as you know, most of the venture funding comes out of, you know, California, New York, Boston, Dan Goldman, right? Boston. So to hear that your initial funders were Iowan, I think that's really awesome. Was it a fund in Iowa, based in Iowa?
Yeah. So there was a few different groups, Ag Startup Engine, Ag Ventures Alliance, just smaller seed stage funds that exist out there. Some of the angel groups in the area, Finn Capital, also some other angels around the Midwest bought in on ClearFlame at an early stage. So yeah, I mean, a lot of the larger funding that we've scaled into, you mentioned Dan was the lead partner from Clean Energy Ventures on the deal. And we obviously wouldn't be here without them, and that's Boston money. Yeah, again, the Midwestern VC sector is still kind of figuring out what they want to be. And You were commenting, most people don't know it. I think one of the groups is even called like flyover capitals. They're owning the way the world sees them, right? but no, it is so much more than that. And I can say ClearFlame, we started our company in Silicon Valley. We moved here to the Midwest for the Argonne opportunity. And at the time, I didn't appreciate being at the intersection of all the freight routes in the middle of the corn belt, the agriculture products, all the diesel OEMs are around here. Mm-hmm. We are a technology that is providing a solution to the parts of the economy that people do ignore, yet are critical for the quality of life that we have on the coast, right? And so I think, No, certainly not judging you for dismissing Iowa, but that, look, I'm a West Coast boy, right? I'll admit it as soon as anyone. And that dismissing of the Midwest as being different and that's somehow inferior. No, it's different and it's critical to who you are too. Right. And seeing ClearFlame being in the heart of that, I think has been a cool shift.
That's amazing. I would love to get the Midwestern ecosystem involved with this podcast and now what's becoming a community. I would really love to do that. Well, we can have that conversation offline. So that 2019... go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think they're up for that. I think they're still trying to figure out, again, what their role is. Like, it's, you can't beat Silicon Valley at its own game. They just have more capital, more experience, will do it better. But what the Midwest brings is complementary and different. And I think they're starting to embrace that. And we're seeing a lot of investment in ag tech these days. And as you know, ag and food cannot be decoupled from energy in any meaningful way.
Absolutely. And so that 2019 to 2020 time period, you're going from incubation to being a business. As you're pointing out, you and Julie went straight from your PhD to founding this company to Argonne and then thrust into the murky waters.
Right? I mean, first off, I would say, you know, we weren't thrust out there. Argonne did help a lot. CRI in particular, Chain Reaction Innovations in particular.
Yeah.
Which was the unit within Argonne. It wasn't, Argonne gave us the technical resources. Chain Reaction Innovations taught us entrepreneurship with support from, like, you know, Booth and University of Chicago. You know, I think the kind of learning curve, and I think this is pretty typical for any engineer becoming entrepreneur, is realizing, you know, you hear perception is reality over and over and over, and you don't actually embrace that as an engineer. You're like, well, no, reality is reality and facts are facts. Like, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. And I think that was when I started to realize that just having a product that made sense for this problem was not good enough.
Yeah.
But explaining how it fit into the overall climate problem. You talked about electrification earlier. Isn't everything going to be electric in 5 years? No. Do we want as much as we can get electric in 5 years and at any time frame? Yes, absolutely. But figuring out the story of how do we fit in a complementary way, that was the big part of that early learning curve. Because coming out of Argonne, there was still plenty of technical work to do. And Julie has had to move mountains to move from the Argonne work to the Cummins X15 engine to the trucks that are going on the road for the end of the year. And in parallel, I've had to learn so much about how to explain that message to people. And it's not, do you have any idea how hard it is to get this truck to move under its own power? to why does that matter, and getting people to appreciate why it matters. That was a long learning curve for me, for sure.
Let's talk a bit more about that, though, crafting that narrative, because quote unquote climate tech seems to have taken off in the last couple of years, especially like post COVID. And there's a lot of money coming in the space and a lot of fresh minds as well, which is great. But as you pointed out that, and I've used it before too, the electrification of everything slogan, I think that people grab onto that. And also the idea that, you know, we need everything to be new technology versus making the older cleaner and grabbing some of that whole low hanging fruit. Can we just talk a bit more of the challenge of crafting that narrative so people understand that the solution that you all are working on is desperately needed now and it is possible now?
Yeah, I think the hardest part of crafting that narrative is, I think it's kind of a distinctly American thing. It's very strong within VC, but this notion of like, you know, you got to win. There's got to be a winner. And of course, there can only be one winner. And I think that is one of the biggest challenges in getting people to understand the Clear Flame narrative. And frankly, the climate narrative as a whole, there is not a silver bullet. There will not be one solution. And the longer we spend looking for a single solution that will solve all of our problems, the longer we'll be perpetuating the status quo in the vast majority of applications. And, you know, maybe if you're talking about, you know, and I think it comes in part from the Silicon Valley world, like Twitter became Twitter because Twitter dominated the micro blogging space, which is now called tweeting, right? Like energy doesn't work that way. The problems are too vast, too distinct, and there are going to be multiple winners. And I think a big part of crafting that narrative is getting people to take a step back and say, transportation is a $1 trillion market. If I'm saying my solution doesn't even work in the majority of that, do you care if it's only 20% of that? And it's probably more than that, by the way. But it's getting people off of that thinking. There is huge opportunity in the white space that people ignore. Mm. And I think the people that are on the cutting edge of investing do understand that it's easy to be a quick follower. It's hard to find the white space to find new solutions. And convincing people that ClearFlame is that white space, which is also complicated because you mentioned we're using a technology that is known and out there, right? So it's like, aren't engines a known quantity? Isn't there no more innovation to be had? There's plenty of innovation to be had. We don't have engines out there right now that are agnostic to whatever low carbon fuel can be out there. There are so many problems that can still be solved. And it's mostly crafting the narrative is largely about awareness and cultivating that awareness. And then once people get that, when they realize this problem is more diverse than they think, oh, transportation is more than the Mazda 3 I interact with, they start to see it. But it is not what the everyday person would see or experience.
Right. And without it being a shiny object, if you will, in the climate tech sea, we run the risk of ending up funding things that seem to be really cool, but might not be possible. And worse yet, might not be impactful in terms of solving the problem.
And to be clear, you know, there are people that only want to invest in electrification. And I think that's fine. In fact, I think that's important. Like the world needs EV zealots. The electric vehicle needs champions that are driving to it, no compromise. Like absolutely. But no, I think it's broader than that. And you said shiny object. And I think, and that's where the narrative building comes in. Like when you think about what Elon Musk has been able to do with Tesla, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a battery and electric motor on wheels. We've had both of those technologies forever. Probably maybe even longer than we've had engines. I don't know. They're both a century old. And he took that known technology and made it shiny. And I think there's something there that ClearFlame can learn and any entrepreneur can learn as well, which is showing the new insight you have and not letting people saddle you down to the old technology. I can't let people say, oh, you're just an engine. No, I have to say we're an engine that will use any decarbonized liquid in the future. Wherever the world goes, we will use that fuel. That is a different story, and one that I think is inherently more powerful because it shows how vast and impactful our solution can be.
Let's take three steps backwards because we're assuming that people know what it is you all do.
Yes, that is fair. I'm making that error right now.
So let's talk about what you all do.
Yeah. So you can think of ClearFlame. Our technology is effectively a parts kit that fits into an existing engine design. You can do it as a retrofit. You can do it as a new product. Doesn't really matter. But what it does is it enables the diesel engine and everything you know about the diesel engine, the torque and efficiency and power and practicality, that is why it dominates such a range of applications. It allows that engine to keep doing everything it needs to do, but it enables a switch using higher temperature combustion to a decarbonized liquid fuel. It can run on something like ethanol, but in contrast to the way this is done before, it is not a conversion to make it an ethanol engine. No, it is to make ethanol work in a diesel style engine, which is a subtle but important difference. From the perspective of the user, it is doing everything that they have come to expect from that engine. It runs the same cycle. It even sounds the same. And so as a result, we are decoupling the economic and practical benefits of the engine from the costs and emissions challenges of diesel fuel. And when I say emissions, I mean both the criteria pollution, the soot and the smog, and also the CO2, of course.
Let's talk about why it's important from a climate perspective. Ethanol, methanol versus diesel fuel.
Ethanol is definitely the easy example because it's overwhelmingly made from a few different pathways. So if you look at the basic ethanol that we have in this country, and I shouldn't use the word basic because that implies it's a stagnant product, which it's not. It's improved a lot and it still is. It is about 45 to 50% lower in CO2 impact on the environment than diesel fuel is today. And so it's not perfect. It's not 100% reduction. I would point out neither is an electric vehicle today, right? Our grid is not perfectly clean. And I think one of the big messages we're telling with ClearFlame is just like we need to get EVs out there and then decarbonize the grid, we need to get engines that can run on decarbonized liquids and then make those decarbonized liquids better. And someday, ethanol will be a carbon neutral fuel. It'll be there within a matter of a decade or two. And when you take that 5 gigaton CO2 number I was telling you about before, 15% of our entire problem, if you could swap that out for ClearFlame, you're cutting that problem in half overnight and then working over the next decade to get it all the way down to zero, right? And we cannot dismiss the ability to make immediate cuts to CO2. That's what the IPCC report showed us, right? Like, we need to stop screwing around. What can we do right now? And the answer is, you can't answer that question without asking what is already out there. And there are only 3 fuels that are nationally scaled in this country: diesel, gasoline, and ethanol. And only one of those is not a fossil product. If we want to start talking about making change now, we got to be serious about what's available now.
In this picture, the future that we need in 10 years is that ethanol produced by companies like 12, formerly Opus 12, that is then utilized by a, should I say, diesel engine modified by ClearFlame?
I would say ClearFlame enabled, but yeah. I'm an engineer. I don't do marketing or branding.
A ClearFlame engine? Yeah.
I think actually the best analog for that is like, it's kind of like Intel Inside, right? Yeah. It's like ClearFlame Inside. We're enabling it something different. But yes, absolutely. 12, Natasha. So she was my thermodynamics TA. So definitely.
Oh, really?
Nicholas, who's been a resource for me early on, just from the Stanford connections. But yeah, I think that's the question of what comes next for the fuels that ClearFlame uses. There are a lot of other, we're going to need plenty of biofuels going forward. I believe that very strongly. But there are going to be e-fuels. There are other pathways as well. And I don't know when the types of fuels that companies like 12 produces will be, you know, a larger volume than what we've got today. It'll happen at some point. But the point is, let's get the engines out there now, and we will use as much of both as we can, because we're a long way from having enough of any of these alternatives, which even if you rope in EV, we are a long way where if you take every alternative, we're barely scratching the surface on the petroleum products we have to displace. And so we need, just like I was saying, we need a lot of solutions. It's not just EV, it's EV and combustion. It's not just corn versus cellulosic ethanol or ethanol versus e-fuels. It's no, we need all of it. It's all better than petroleum. Let's do it all. I do want to make one more point on 12, which is, yeah, they can turn captured CO2 into a lot of things. And do you know what is one of the best sources of pure CO2? The ethanol production process. Mm. The fermentation process produces a lot of, it's actually the largest source of food grade CO2 we have in this country. When COVID happened and the gasoline demand shrunk and all the ethanol went away, the soda producers were like, crap, where's my CO2? And so I think there's the ability to improve the traditional ethanol process with the type of stuff Atasha and 12 are doing. First kind of follow on point there, the infrastructure, again, when I said there's only three fuels that are at scale, that is both at production and it's also at distribution. Ethanol is blended basically into all the gasoline we have in this country. And it's nationally distributed as E98, as basically pure ethanol. And so when you get your gasoline at the pump, it's probably about 10% ethanol. That's because a truck drove to a fuel rack, filled up 90% of the way with gasoline, pure gasoline, topped off with ethanol and drove there. But there's no reason in the future that they can just drive there, say, hey, I'm filling up a clear flame enabled fleet, so I only need the ethanol, thank you, which is better economically and environment.
Mm. Okay. So I want to shift gears here and turn to some quick fire questions. What are three books that have had a profound impact on the way you live life and or do business?
Picking up on live life first, because that's always the easy one for me. To Kill a Mockingbird. I know a lot of people give answers like that. I mean, it is a great book. Particularly Atticus Finch as a character in that book. And I think it was a quote that I used either in my yearbook or at graduation in high school. But when he's talking to Scout about his daughter, about, you know, what courage is. And it's not a man with a gun in his hand. It's taking on a problem, because he was talking about he ultimately failed in the defense of his client because his client was Black, and basically saying like, she was like, well, if you knew he was going to fail, why'd you do it? And he's like, that's what courage is. It's taking on a problem that, you know, you can't win and fighting it anyway, because the fight is what's right. That's always been a big guiding influence on my life. When I start thinking about business, There are a couple of good kind of recent books. Like, there's a lot of good Gladwell books out there. You know, Outliers is always one that sticks out. As I think it's important for anyone to realize that, you know, our success is just dependent on so many intangible, not even intangible, but just circumstances that are out of our control. I mean, look at ClearFlame. We were the first cohort of CRI. Like, if we had been the fifth cohort, we might have been lost in the noise of EV. We raised our seed round right before COVID. And I think a lot of Gladwell's work goes to, I think it helps ingrain humility in that, like, yeah, you're a product of forces that are far beyond your control. That doesn't mean you don't have the ability to make the most of it, but you got to acknowledge that as well. Loon Shots is one I would recommend, you know, how you actually foster deep innovation. It's what I kind of think about when I build ClearFlame. And the final one I'd give is, and this one's a bit antiquated, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. It's a book out of the 60s, and kind of what led to the scientific revolutions of, you know, Copernicus and the Earth orbiting the sun and all that kind of stuff. And the thesis of the book is, it's not just the result of natural scientific progress, but also of crisis that shows how we've been thinking about the world is an incomplete picture. To use the Copernicus example, like, oh, wait, we can't figure out how the solar system works if it's an Earth-centric solar system. Something must be wrong. I think there's an analog there for ClearFlame, and that I think ClearFlame has an opportunity right now because there is crisis. The climate is effed right now and we need to fix it. And this silver bullet logic is proving to be insufficient.
Mm.
It's the right time to interject ourselves into that narrative too, not just the right narrative. And you never succeed if it's not both the right technology and at the right time. And I think that points to that.
That's amazing. And I appreciate the courage that you have and the way that you approach fear and the problem that you are tackling. And we need hundreds more entrepreneurial people like you to go out there and do the same, so that in 2030, we're living on a planet in conditions that we want to live in.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. And I think what I would say is we need hundreds of people, maybe thousands, but I would say there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people out there with that skill set. And I think the biggest thing I would encourage to anyone listening is if you believe that you can make a difference, however you think you can make a difference, maybe it's starting a company, maybe it's something that you might think is smaller than that. But I'm not going to sit here and talk about what is small and what is big. If you believe you can make a difference, go out and make a difference in the way that you can. And I think that's a message everyone needs to hear. I think it's also a message that diverse audiences need to hear, because I think there's only a sub-segment of the population that thinks entrepreneurship is even available to them, right? Mm. And that's not true. The world is ready for a broader range of solutions. And it's hard. It's scary. You know, I'm half Black. Julie's a woman. Like, there's plenty of challenges around that. But you don't have to be limited by that. Real talk, it makes it harder in some ways, for sure. But you don't have to be limited. And we need more people willing to stand up and say, I'll fight that fight. Even if I might lose, I'll fight that fight.
Here, here. Cheers to that.
Cheers to that.
Other rapid fire question. What are three startups and or founders that you absolutely love and you want other people to know about?
I mean, we already listed one, Natasha, Nicholas, and 12. If you don't know who they are, you should. One I always have to throw out there is Gene Bartoszewski at Sila. They are doing next generation battery technology. That is an extraordinarily successful company that is far farther along than either us or 12 is. And Gene is a good example of someone for how you should operate in the space. But I think also the fact that Gene is willing to take his time to help someone like me says a lot about who he is. And I think the pay it forward aspect is so important. I would definitely highlight him. There's a lot of companies that I've met through CRI, Justin and Tyler at Emergy, which is now Meaty. You know, I'd always highlight them as they have their origin story as in the same place as ClearFlame. They were also in that first cohort with us. And I remember when they were trying to make charcoal filters for wastewater. Now they're making alternative meat, right? it shows what the flexibility of entrepreneurship requires. And if I had to highlight one, that these are people I don't know personally, but there's a company called Remora. R-E-M-O-R-A. They're working on adding carbon capture to trucks. And I got to give them a shout out for sure, because there's not a lot of people looking at what can we do about the truck problem, and figuring out how to take carbon out of the tailpipe is a huge step in the right direction. And I would point out that if you combine that type of technology with an engine like ClearFlame that can use a lower carbon liquid fuel, you're starting to talk about carbon negative solutions, that every mile that truck drives has the net effect of taking CO2 out of the atmosphere, which is, as you know, the goal.
Yeah, that's amazing. So are there any final thoughts that you want to leave listeners today that they can carry forward with them in their coming hours, days, weeks, months, years?
Yeah, I think there are two that are always top of mind for me. And it's both doubling down on previous comments. The first is, it's going to take a range of solutions. And if something sounds different, you should not dismiss it. And you should actually see, hey, wait, maybe this is an opportunity. Because if we don't start talking about diversity of solutions, we are not going to solve this problem. The second to that, and I think a bit of a corollary, is if we are going to come up with the best solutions in the world to solve this problem, and we need the best solutions in the world to solve this problem, those solutions are going to come from a room full of people that look like the world. No disrespect to him, but like, just because you don't look like Elon Musk or have the same gender as Elon Musk does not mean that your idea is any less valuable. Again, real talk. There are forces in the world that lead ideas coming from those types of people to be discounted. And that means they're even more likely, as they rise to the top, to be really good effing ideas. And people need to feel empowered by that, to get their ideas out there, to share it, fight on their merits, because we're not there yet. But we're approaching a world where people are willing to listen. And that's a big step in the right direction.
I also appreciate your prescribing to the philosophy of paying it forward and participating in this podcast. And I'm really looking forward to seeing you all again in person, hopefully in Chicago in the coming months when we're able to, and catching up on all of your progress that you all have made and will continue to make. And I hope nothing best for you all. And I'm sure it's a bright, bright future ahead for you and your team.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity. May the force be with you might be an appropriate tie into the intro, although normally I don't end conversations that way. But no, I enjoyed the opportunity to share the vision.
Absolutely. I was going to say that my favorite Star Wars episode is Return of the Jedi, but I didn't want to upset you.
I know that's a plant for sure. And that came from both Julie and Kendra. No real person has this opinion.
Well, there is Jabba the Hutt and the Ewoks, which are super cute and a force for good.
I have no response to this statement.
At least I didn't say it's episode one and my favorite character is Jar Jar Binks.
Okay, okay. You're right. You are off the hook. That's ending the conversation on a positive note for sure.
Well, may the force be with you and with all of you listening, and have a great rest of the week.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Matt.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening. The resources that we mentioned and everything else we talked about, drink recipes, various people, companies, so on and so forth, will all be linked in the show notes on our Substack at climatetechcocktails.substack.com. If you want to write us, our email address is m@climatetechcocktails.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at @CT_cocktails and on Instagram, #climatetechcocktails. You can reach me personally by carrier pigeon or on my LinkedIn /Matthew J. Myers. Until next time, keep the dream alive and do your part to make the world a better place for 100% of humanity. And thanks for tuning in.